My name is John Lorden, and I've been looking into hundreds of unsolved mysteries over the past 5 years on my YouTube channel, Lorden Arts. And I've been known to bring a respectful, victim-focused approach to the stories that I cover while donating thousands of dollars directly to those cases and the charities that help them. Now, I'm bringing that approach and sensibility, along with some of the biggest mysteries I've ever looked into and some new ones, to a weekly podcast called Seriously Mysterious. From bizarre occurrences to unsolved murders and unexplainable disappearances, everything is fair game on this show as long as it's seriously mysterious. You can find Seriously Mysterious on your favorite podcatchers or by visiting seriouslymysterious.com. Let's look into the mysterious together.
You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
It was 1984. On August 5th at 7:09 a.m., average citizen Charles G. was driving to work in Sanford, Florida. He cruised down Riverview Avenue and was about to make a left onto Old State Road 46 when he saw something out of the corner of his eye. It was a woman sitting slumped over in the overgrown grass next to a vacant house, wearing only underpants. Charles stopped his car and yelled out the window to the woman. No answer and no movement. He got out of his car and walked closer. He noted that the woman was stone still, and there were articles of clothing strewn all over the ground near her. Charles quickly noted the address and drove right back to his house and called the police from the landline. Once the call was placed, he drove back to the site to wait for the cops. At 7:23 a.m., Seminole County Deputy Sheriff John Thompson responded to 2418 Old State Road 46 in Sanford, in reference to a deceased female found on the side of a house. The house had a for sale sign out front and was abandoned-looking, with tall weeds and a sagging vine-covered front porch. When Deputy Sheriff Thompson arrived, he saw Charles G., who had called the police. He also found Seminole County Fire Department personnel already on scene. First responders found the woman wearing only white underwear. Their notes about her state, quote, "She was in a sitting position, slumped with head and arms forward in a semi-fetal position," end quote. A further report from Crime Scene Sergeant Chad Barton said, quote, "The victim is found in a face-forward position, face down with her hands in an approximate position beneath the face, elbows outstretched. The knees are buckled in a kneeling position. The body is in a position consistent with almost a bow," end quote. Barton's report continued, quote, "A small quantity of blood is seen exuding from the ears and nose of the victim. A larger quantity of what appears to be blood and feces is observed in the anal area. Numerous insect bites are present on the body. The body is cold to the touch," end quote. Firefighter and EMT James Williams pronounced the woman deceased at 7:29 a.m. He observed that full rigor had set in, meaning that she was likely within 48 hours of death. It was a very strange scene. The slumped-over dead woman was not the only thing there. Bags of stuff and various pieces of clothing lay on the ground. Two of these items were the white pants and matching short-sleeve top comprising a U.S. Navy uniform. The name Kahanis was stamped inside the collar of the shirt. Deputies went through all the strewn items looking for an ID card that could confirm who the dead woman was. They located a U.S. Navy ID card in her front blouse pocket and a Liberty Pass, both in the name of Pamela Jane Kahanas. A call was made to the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS, to try to confirm that this ID was accurate. I'm going to do away with this suspense here and state up front that the woman was Navy recruit Pam Kahanas. Sergeant Chad Barton, Crimes Against Persons Division Sergeant Jim Thorpe, and Investigator Greg Futch began to process the scene. They collected a single black pubic hair that was found on the back of the dead woman's left shoulder. The crime scene techs also collected a tiny piece of blue material that resembled cellophane from her right shoulder. What this material is has never been identified. The CSIs then turned to the smorgasbord of items scattered on the ground near the deceased woman. The left pant leg of Pam's uniform pants was rolled up and had grease on it. The white belt was still in place in the loops. A police report states, quote, "A fiber mass was removed from this pair of pants, as was a fiber from the interior waistband," end quote. These were both yellow carpet fibers. Pam's navy hat also lay next to her. A pair of inside-out black socks lay on the ground as well. Next to the body, along with the uniform and socks, were Pam's size 8 black navy issue shoes inside a black bag. Inside her blouse front pocket was $116 in cash and several hundred dollars in traveler's checks. None appeared to be missing based on the sequence numbers. Several shopping bags containing new purchases were scattered around the grass. The bags were from the Navy Exchange, Kmart, and the Fashion Square Mall Sears. Pam, who was supposed to start a new Navy assignment in Orlando that coming Monday, had bought 2 new white military belts, white socks, and a U.S. Navy notebook. A Navy Exchange receipt with the date August 4, 1984, on it accounted for these purchases. Pam had also bought a bunch of new toiletries, like Maybelline tweezers, a new maxi eyeliner, a tub of henna cream, a bottle of Sally Hansen Quick Off Nail Remover, and Cashmere Bouquet body powder. Finally, there was a perplexing blend of worn and new clothing in the bags. A new blue bathing suit had been purchased that day, but a white washcloth with yellow stains and a pair of stained yellow shorts that looked like they had been in contact with some kind of plants or grass were also in the bags. Lab tests were never able to identify the source of these stains. Finally, a Chinese takeout carton lay on the ground. A stained white napkin lay about 15 feet from the body. A receipt in the amount of $5.41 with the time and date of 1:09 a.m. August 5th on it was also found. No business name was on the receipt. The unlocked vacant house where Pam was found in the yard was a 2-story wooden house with a dirt driveway. Pam lay on the east side of the driveway. Fresh tire tracks were evident in the dirt. These were photographed and casted. The interior of the vacant house has never been ruled out as the crime scene, but investigators came to believe that Pam was not killed at the location where she was found, and that she was likely transported to that spot by a vehicle and dumped along with all of her stuff. They hoped that the tire marks would lead them to an identification of the make and model of the car that had dropped off Pam's body and her things. Seminole County Medical Examiner Dr. Sarah Ergang arrived at the scene. The body was photographed in place and then removed to the ME's office, located at Central Florida Regional Hospital. At 3:45 p.m., the victim was positively identified as 25-year-old Pamela Jane Kahanas by Deborah K. Butt, the company commander of K-083, the recruit class that Pam Kahanas had just graduated with. An autopsy on Pam was performed by Dr. Ergang at 10:40 a.m. on August 6, 1984. Pam's only clothing, her underwear, were collected and put in evidence. Dr. Ergang noted that Pam suffered from extensive bruising and contusions of the neck. The contusions covered a large part of the front of her throat, a patch about 4 by 6 centimeters wide. A neck dissection revealed that her hyoid bone was broken in 2 or 3 places, and she had extensive hemorrhage in the anterior neck, in the muscles, and around the thyroid cartilage. Her lungs exhibited congestion and blood consistent with oxygen deprivation. The official cause of death was cerebral anoxia caused by external pressure compression of the vessels of the neck. The manner of death was homicide. The strangulation was either manual or with the use of a hard object pushed down on her throat like a broomstick. It took her between 8 and 10 minutes to die, the ME estimated. Pam's body also bore several contusions that revealed that she had been in a fight for her life. She had multiple scrapes on her face, at her hairline, and behind her left ear, and her nose was broken. Marks on her throat, just under her chin, were believed to be scrapes and half moons from her own fingernails, as her hands scrabbled to loosen whatever was constricting her throat. Consequently, the medical examiner collected scrapings from under all 10 of Pamela's fingernails, and cut the nails as well, and retained the clippings. CSI Robert Kobeck took custody of these items, as well as 2 head hair standards and 2 pubic hair standards. In the course of her examination of Pam, Dr. Irgang noted that Pam's vagina contained small amounts of whitish fluid. Around the anus was also a small amount of hemorrhagic material. Vaginal and anal swabs were collected and handed to Investigator Kopeck for evidence. Smears taken from the swabs and examined under a microscope revealed no sperm. Pam's stomach contents were partially digested vegetable matter, telling Dr. Irgang she had eaten fairly recently. The tox screen results would later prove negative for drugs and showed only a minor level of alcohol. Let's talk about who Pam was. Pamela Jane Kahanas was born on August 24, 1958, in Stillwater, Minnesota, to parents Alice and Louis Kahanas. She grew up on her family's 200-acre dairy farm. She was the 7th of 8 children, 6 girls and 2 boys. The family spent a lot of time together. They played softball, fished, went on bike rides, and worked around the farm. Stillwater had just 10,000 residents, and the family were simple, hardworking country folk. But Pam wanted more. After high school, she moved to Big City St. Paul, 20 miles away, to work for a publishing company. She worked as a key punch operator for 3 years, but she didn't love it. Pam's brother Doug told the Sun Sentinel in 2015 that in 1984, Pam had broken up with her boyfriend and wanted a change and wanted to see the world. She decided to join the Navy, following in her father's footsteps. She was worried that her parents wouldn't approve of her choice to leave Minnesota, but her older sister Eileen encouraged her to make her own choices. Her parents accepted it, and when the time came on May 23, 1984, her mom drove her to the airport. Pam commenced 3 months of basic training as a Navy Recruit Airman Apprentice at Recruit Training Command, Naval Training Center, Orlando, Florida. At age 25, she was significantly older than most of the other women in her class, who were closer to 19 or 20. Pam didn't have a lot of close friends in her recruit class. This may have been because of the age and maturity difference, and it could also have been because she was originally assigned to Company K-077. But she was held back and reassigned to Company K-083. Some reports indicate this was her request, as she felt she needed more time to complete the training. Her petty officer, Dickie Johnson, said Pam was a little slow to master bunk maintenance, possibly because she spent a lot of time rehearsing for the Blue Jackets choral group she was part of. The daily training program was rigorous and demanding. Recruits were woken at 5 a.m. and had to fall in line, impeccably dressed, their bunk areas spotless, within 15 minutes. The days were a series of strenuous drills and boring military history classes. Evenings were for some leisure time, but the recruits were not allowed to leave the female barracks. They wrote letters, chatted, or just went to bed. The recruits were strictly forbidden from socializing with their male counterparts, and indeed, they didn't have the opportunity to. It was all business. The recruits were with their fellows 24/7 and didn't engage in partying, drinking, or even fun. They weren't permitted to wear makeup or non-military issue clothing, and their hair had to be cut on the short side. It was pretty austere. That all ended on August 3, 1984, when the recruits finally graduated from basic training. This was a big deal. Many families of recruits attended the graduation ceremony, and the mood was celebratory. There are some photos of Pam with her arms around her fellow recruits in their Navy whites, smiling. It was a huge relief to have boot camp behind them. Pam's family didn't come down for the graduation. The Orlando Sentinel did an article about Pam's case, reporting that on that Saturday, when she was believed to have been killed, 9 members of her family were having a reunion at their home in Stillwater, Minnesota. At the reunion, They discussed what a shame it was that Pam wasn't able to come home for the reunion because of her strict recruit schedule at the Orlando Naval Training Center. They would never see her alive again. Pam's family received the devastating phone call that their daughter and sister had been found murdered. Of course, homicide was the furthest thing from their minds when they dropped her off at the airport to join the Navy. Her mother, Alice, told the Sentinel, quote, "She was a happy-go-lucky girl who loved life. She was outgoing, wanted more for herself, and worked hard to get it," end quote. But Alice also suspected that Pam's sheltered upbringing had contributed to her fate. She said that Pam was trusting by nature, never having been exposed to much outside small Stillwater. "She was a good person. She didn't need to be hurt. There was no violence in her body," Alice said. Pam was buried in the Naval Cemetery in Fort Snelling in Minneapolis. Her father, a veteran of World War II, would be buried in the same cemetery in 2001. He died never knowing what happened to his daughter. I'd like to welcome a new sponsor to the show, HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. I don't know about you guys, but with putting out a podcast episode a week, I really don't have time to go to the grocery store. But I care about what I put in my body, and I also love delicious, well-balanced meals. HelloFresh is a lifesaver. They deliver right to my doorstep, so I never have to go to the store in order to make a mouth-watering meal for my family. Each HelloFresh box is packed with farm-fresh ingredients, and each meal is pre-portioned, which means no more unused wilted greens in my produce drawer. And it's not like some other meal services I've tried where you see the same meals on constant rotation. HelloFresh offers an incredible variety of meals with its biggest menu yet, featuring over 45 dinner options to choose from weekly, and even more market add-on items for snacks and light bites. After I've spent a day researching and writing a podcast episode, the last thing I want to do is dig out a cookbook and find a recipe to make. HelloFresh does it all for me. The recipes are incredibly easy to follow, with step-by-step instructions that yield outstanding results. I can't wait for my next box with the shrimp and asparagus risotto with Meyer lemon and Parmesan, and my husband's personal favorite, the chicken parm salad. And get this, HelloFresh is currently offering all subscribers free breakfast for life. That means you'll enjoy a totally free breakfast item with every single HelloFresh delivery. You simply can't pass that up. Go to HelloFresh.com/DNAFree and use code DNAFree for free breakfast for life. One breakfast item per box while subscription is active. That's free breakfast for life at HelloFresh.com/DNAFree with code DNAFree. Okay, let's talk about the investigation. The Seminole County Sheriff's Office and the Naval Criminal Investigative Services worked the case jointly, trying to find out who had killed naval recruit Pam Kahanis. One aspect of surviving boot camp and making it through graduation that everyone looked forward to was the Liberty Pass. After the graduation ceremony, the recruits were issued Liberty Passes for the entire weekend, which enabled them to leave the base for the first time in months. They were also permitted to socialize with the male recruits and to go to the base bar called the Mariners Club. Investigators set out to recreate Pam's last movements. They searched her bunk area for any clues to how and with whom she had spent her last few hours. They found her things neatly arranged, her pay for her services as a recruit exchanged for money orders and traveler's checks. NCIS Special Agents C.D. Wood and C. Falk conducted interviews of Pam's fellow recruits, and they found a lot of witnesses who had seen Pam, helping the investigators reconstruct her last hours. Now, it has to be said that quite a few of these sightings of Pam seem unreliable, given what we now know about what happened to her. Investigators learned that after the graduation ceremony on Friday, August 3rd, 1984, Pam went to the Mariners Club and socialized and danced. Classmates Bronte N. and Tina B. both saw Pam on Friday night at the Mariners Club alone. She was buying a drink for herself and was not in the company of anyone. But Amy W. saw Pam dancing with a guy she knew as Jamie, who had been stationed in Orlando for the past 3 years and lived off base. Amy described Jamie as a white male, around 22 years old, with brown hair and a mustache. Amy actually spoke to this guy Jamie and asked if he knew Pam, and he said no, but Pam had asked him to dance. Amy and Jamie made plans to go out on Saturday the 4th. That day, Saturday, August 4th, for the first time since May, Pam had the day to herself and was allowed to do what she liked. So what did she do? She went shopping. Pam saw her classmate Kimberly Z at their lockers on Saturday morning. Pam told Sue that she'd stayed out really late at the Mariners Club and didn't get back to the barracks until 2:30 or 3 in the morning the night before. Pam chatted away, telling Kim she was going shopping. Kim specifically recalled that Pam was dressed in a pair of shorts and had her ditty bag with her. Sometime after that, a woman named Helena S. saw Pam, she believed around 8:30 a.m. Pam was dressed now in her navy white uniform, and she had her navy-issued purse with her. Navy whites were required attire for naval recruits going off base. Around 10 a.m., recruit Josie C. saw Pam dressed in her seaman whites. Pam was alone and told Josie she was going shopping at the Navy Exchange and then the Fashion Square Mall in search of makeup, a bike lock, soap, and a swimsuit. Pam had her navy purse and possibly her ditty bag with her. The investigators noted with interest that Josie reported that Pam told her that she had a date that night, but she didn't say who the guy was. She was planning on going back to the barracks after her shopping trip to change and then go out. Sherry P. saw Pam at 11:15 a.m. at a bus stop across from the Naval Training Center. She was holding her purse and presumably waiting to board the bus to the mall. Between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m., Pam was seen by multiple witnesses shopping at the Fashion Square Mall. For example, a classmate named Laura G. saw her looking into a shoe store window. This was at 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. Pam was wearing her white navy uniform, holding her hat in her hand, carrying her navy-issued purse and a white shopping bag. In a very important conversation, Laura asked Pam if she was going to be going out later, and Pam told her she might stop over at the Mariners Club. However, Laura went to the Mariners Club that Saturday night, and she never saw Pam there. Investigators found a receipt in the Kmart bag that had been found near Pam's body that documented a purchase she had made at the Herndon Plaza Kmart, right near the mall, at 3:18 p.m. She bought toiletries and makeup. And they found a female witness who said she had seen Pam leaving the Kmart on Saturday afternoon and getting into a car with a white man who was carrying her packages. The two seemed friendly. The investigators put a lot of stock into this eyewitness sighting because they noted that the witness was someone, quote, trained in observation who positively identified Pam, end quote. However, this man has never been identified, although not for lack of trying. The investigators knew that Pam's familiarity with men outside the Naval Training Center was very limited. As a recruit, she hadn't been permitted to leave the base and was restricted from socializing. So they suspected that this man who was friendly with Pam must be someone she knew from the Naval Training Center, or NTC. A male recruit, an instructor, a drill sergeant, someone from the mess hall. They had no idea who he was. But Pam had written a letter home to her mother on August 1st, saying that she had crushes on two men in her brother company. Their names were Vasquez and Allen, and I'm not saying their last names. Investigators were stymied to learn that these men were not listed in the Navy's records. Who were they? How had Pam met them? And could one or both of them have been involved in her death? To this day, no one knows who these men were. But the sighting of Pam getting into an unknown man's vehicle was not the last time Pam was seen that day. Felicia M. said she saw Pam around 6:30 p.m. near the Fashion Square Mall with a man in a white Navy uniform. He was possibly Hispanic, medium build, 5'6" with dark hair. And then, sometime between 6:30 and 7 p.m., Pam was seen with an unidentified male walking on Main Street in front of the base. The witness could not recall what the man looked like. That appears to be the last credible sighting of Pam, again, given what we now know. But at the time, so many people told the investigators that they saw Pam on Saturday night at the Mariners Club that the investigators prioritized that angle and looked for persons of interest from the club. No fewer than three people the investigators talked to said they saw Pam at the Mariners Club dancing with a white guy with dark hair. Two of them, Amy W. and Christine K., even named him Jamie B., the same guy she had been dancing with at the same club the night before. Even though several people said they saw Pam at the Mariners Club on Saturday night, no one saw her leaving the club. But recall the Chinese food carton that was found with her body and the unidentified receipt for $5.41 at 1:09 a.m. on the 5th. Pam's stomach contents when she was found were consistent with her eating vegetables as her last meal, sometime within hours of her death. The investigators made the leap that the receipt pertained to the Chinese food purchase, even though that was pure speculation. The narrative of Pam's last few hours became, she was seen at the Mariners Club in the company of a white male, she went for Chinese food late that night, and she ended up dead in the side yard of an abandoned house in Sanford 6 hours later. I'm not sure if this goes to a sloppy investigation or what, but 3 days after Pam was found, a man named Kem M. contacted the Seminole County Sheriff's Office about a bra he and his wife had spotted. They were driving down Riverside Avenue in Sanford when they observed a yellow sheet lying in a yard. The couple recognized that they had seen the police using this same sheet to cover up the body in the yard of 2418 Old State Road 46 just a few days earlier. They stopped to check out the yellow sheet, and Ken's wife saw a white bra on the side of the road near the curb. This was on the south side of Old State Road 46, just east of Riverview Avenue. Ken and his wife contacted the sheriff's office, who retrieved the bra, as well as an empty pill bottle found inside one of the bra cups. The pill bottle had the name Perry H. on it, but the bra was white, size 34B, and had the name Kahanis stamped inside it. Pam's bra was found 200 feet from where her body had been found. From where it lay, investigators guessed it had been thrown out of a car window. Perry H., a local mechanic, was located and interviewed on November 28th. He could shed no light on the crime. An investigation into him and his activities led nowhere. Investigators were stumped by the murder and the very odd crime scene. With Pam's things scattered all around her in such a haphazard fashion, the crime looked like a robbery. But $116 in cash and over $400 in traveler's checks found in her uniform pocket didn't mesh with that theory. The lack of sperm in the swabs taken at autopsies seemed to undermine a sex crime theory. But the pubic hair found clinging to her shoulder was determined not to be hers, and that seemed to indicate that a sex act was involved after all. One latent print collected from the plastic Sears bag didn't link to anyone. And the fact that Pam just didn't know that many men made for a small suspect pool and a large number of unanswered questions. The investigators interviewed all of Pam's recruit classmates, from both her initial class and her graduating class. It has to be said that quite a few of them were mean girls who were snide or even downright snarky about Pam. It's clear they thought of her as a bit of a hick. A lot of them said she was a loner who didn't really fit in. This from an investigative report, quote, "The interviews yielded that Pamela Jane Kahanis was very trusting of anyone in the military and would often approach males at the Mariners Club and ask them to dance. Some of the individuals identified as having danced with Pam were James C., Fred B., Ronald H., and Reginald M. Each of these men were interviewed and provided adequate information indicating they weren't with Pam at the time of her death," end quote. So these four were ruled out. But pretty soon, the investigators focused on a suspect, someone whom I would even call the prime suspect, who looked very good for Pam's murder. You'll recall that several witnesses reported seeing Pam dancing with a guy named Jamie B. on both Friday and Saturday nights at the Mariners Club. Well, Jamie had no alibi for the Saturday night Pam was believed to have been killed. He also owned a Kawasaki motorcycle. Why did that matter? Well, the investigators had formed a theory that Pam may have ridden on a motorcycle with someone. This was because, if you recall, her left uniform pant leg was found rolled up. This was something she might do if she were riding on a motorcycle and not wanted to get grease on her white pant leg. They wondered if Pam and Jamie had maybe left the Mariners Club together and Pam ended up dead. There was, in fact, grease found on Pam's pant leg, and the pants were submitted to the FBI to try to determine the origin of the grease, but they weren't successful. On August 20th, NCIS Special Agent Falk interviewed Jamie B. They didn't tell him what they were investigating, and they asked him if they could fingerprint him. Remember, a usable, latent print had been found on the Sears bag near Pam's body. Jamie immediately asked if the reason they were talking to him was the Pam Kahanis case. He immediately began to ask them questions about it and speculate about the circumstances surrounding her death. He said he and his friends had talked the whole thing over, and they all thought that Pam had been with someone who made sexual advances toward her, and she jumped out of the car and ran, but the guy caught up with her and assaulted her. Jamie guessed she would have made it maybe 40 or 50 feet, which was oddly and creepily specific and correct. He said he was interested in the case because he hoped to go into law enforcement someday, but the NCIS agent found him to be overly interested in the details. There was more. Jamie admitted to giving Pam a ride on his motorcycle. He drove her the very short distance from the Mariners Club to the barracks where she lived. And Jamie said he couldn't recall whether this was on Friday night or Saturday night. The agents interviewed Jamie's roommates, and they said they didn't know where he was around 1 a.m. on Saturday night, August 4th, but he wasn't at home. Not a good look. On the 22nd, Special Agent Falk and Investigator Greg Futch tried to interview Jamie again. This time, he refused to cooperate. He indicated that he wanted to talk to an attorney, and that pretty much put an end to that for the time being. The investigators had to turn their attention elsewhere. They checked out another guy whom Pam was known to like, named Ronald H. Police had heard reports that he was seen with Pam at the Mariners Club late on the night of August 4th. But they learned that Ronald was issued orders and transferred out on the 3rd. His Navy service record book verified this. He was gone a whole day before Pam was killed. They looked at a guy named Donald E. because they had heard that Pam was supposed to go out with him. On the 22nd, Special Agent Falk and Investigator Futch interviewed Donald E. He denied having any involvement in Pam's death, and they had no direct evidence to contradict his assertion of innocence. They checked all the car rental companies to see if Pam had possibly rented a vehicle, since she was found a good distance from the Navy base. No luck. They arranged for photo lineups for witnesses who claimed they had seen Pam that Saturday afternoon and evening with an unidentified male. The lineups included photos of Jamie B. and Donald E., but no one could identify either of them as the man they saw with Pam. They tracked down a traveler's check that was missing from a book of traveler's checks found in Pam's locker. It turned out she herself had spent it on the 4th at the Navy Exchange on the base. They turned to forensics. The tire tracks found at the scene were identified as being made by Bridgestone tires, one of the most common brands. Yellow fibers found on Pam's clothing were identified as coming from carpeting, possibly the kind found in automobiles. But without a comparison vehicle, the fibers provided few clues. The investigators spent a lot of time in Sanford, canvassing the area where Pam was found. They found pretty much nothing. I was told that this was an early misstep by the original investigators. They prioritized the dump area and people affiliated with it, rather than the people in Pam's orbit at NTC Orlando. After 2 years of active investigation, the case was placed on inactive status. Nine years later, in August 1995, the Seminole County Sheriff's Office and NCIS Southeast Field Office Cold Case Squad reactivated the Pam Kahanas homicide investigation. Sheriff's Investigator Ray Parker worked with NCIS agents Stephen Cabanillas and Michael McDonnell. The team took another look at the hair found on Pam's shoulder. A microscopic analysis by Robert Kopeck concluded that the hair was a Caucasian pubic hair, dissimilar to that of Pam's. In other words, the pubic hair on her shoulder had come from a white person, not Pam. For that reason, as well as the multiple witness sightings of Pam dancing with a white man at the Mariners Club, the investigators focused on white suspects. This would turn out to be a mistake. The hair analysis was erroneous. The 1995 investigators turned to the original prime suspect who had never been ruled out, Jamie B. He was white and could very well be the source of the pubic hair. He had lawyered up when they tried to interview him. Now, they learned something very interesting from interviews with his ex-wife, Marianne. They had been married on New Year's Eve 1984, when Jamie was in the Navy. She said that Jamie's car at the time was an old yellow Hornet. It was a piece of junk, but he'd replaced the carpet anyway. The investigators immediately thought back to the yellow carpet fibers that were found on Pam's clothing. Marianne wasn't able to recall when exactly Jamie had procured the Hornet, but the replacement of the carpeting in a yellow vehicle was very interesting. Oh, and by the way, Marianne mentioned that Jamie loved Chinese food. So they lined up another interview with Jamie B. They hadn't talked to him in 11 years. They went to his house in Lancaster, South Carolina on August 30, 1995. Present were Investigator Parker and NCIS Investigator Cabanillas, as well as Agent Hal Gregory from SLED, the South Carolina State Investigative Agency. Jamie didn't want his current wife to hear the conversation, so they all spoke in the driveway. The investigators told Jamie that they were continuing to investigate the Pam Kahanas homicide, but that he wasn't under arrest and he could ask them to leave at any time. Jamie said he had no problem talking to them, but he knew nothing about the case and they must have the wrong person. He asked what the victim looked like. They showed him a photo of Pam, and Jamie said she looked familiar and he might have danced with her at the Mariners Club. He said, quote, "I was drinking pretty heavy at that time. Maybe I was drunk when I did this," end quote. Guys, PSA, if you're innocent, don't say incriminating stuff like that. Thinking back, Jamie thought he did meet and dance with Pam at the Mariners Club on base one time. He remembered recruit graduation weekend in 1984, but he had no idea whether he danced with her on Friday night or Saturday night. He also remembered he gave her a ride on his Kawasaki 750 motorcycle from the Mariners Club to the barracks. When asked, he said he didn't recall Pam rolling her pant leg up, as the ride was less than a mile, and he explained that if someone needed to roll up their pant leg while on his motorcycle to avoid getting grease on the pants, it would have been the right pant leg. Investigators knew that Pam's left pant leg was the rolled one. Jamie said he remembered Pam wore his helmet and had her uniform hat in her hand for the short ride to the barracks. He didn't go inside with her or even ever get off his bike. The investigators asked Jamie what Pam had with her when she got on the bike. He said just her purse. No other bags like shopping bags or anything could have fit on the motorcycle. They asked him about his yellow AMC Hornet, and he said he'd bought the car just before Pam was murdered, he thought. He admitted he did rip out the carpeting and reupholster it, but he said Pam had never been in his car. Jamie categorically denied having sex with Pam on that weekend. He said, frankly, he wasn't having sex with anyone right then because he was on medication to clear up an STD. Investigator Parker thought maybe if he dangled something in front of Jamie, he would confess. He told Jamie again they weren't there to arrest him and that he and the other investigators agreed this wasn't a first-degree murder case. He said they all agreed that Pam was a willing sexual participant up to a point and that something must have happened that changed her mind and a struggle ensued. The victim ran and he, Jamie, chased her and strangled her. This is a quote from the report. Parker repeated that if Jamie did not kill the victim, he should tell the investigators to get the hell off my property, to which Jamie stated, "You're just doing your job," end quote. This guy can't get out of his own way. They then asked Jamie if he would provide a sample of his blood and pubic hair, and he said he would absolutely do so. He agreed to ride with the investigators to the hospital and went into his house to tell his wife where he was going. They went to the hospital, and blood and pubic hair samples were obtained. Okay, this is a crazy part from the report. Brace yourselves. Quote, "When Jamie B's blood and pubic hair samples were obtained, Investigator Parker was in the room and immediately noticed the purple and brown discoloration on Jamie's penis. When asked what it was, Jamie replied, quote, "I had poison ivy when I was little and I scratched it and that's what happened," end quote. Ouchie. Upon leaving the hospital, Investigator Parker took Jamie aside and said, "Jamie, is that what caused all this? The fact that she saw your penis and thought you had some kind of venereal disease? Did she freak out or belittle you and the result was you killed her? Is that what caused her to stop being a willing sexual partner?" Jamie stood looking at the ground and never said a word, end quote. So here's what they had on Jamie B at this point. Investigator Parker laid it all out to him. Jamie was seen dancing with Pam as late as 9 p.m. on Saturday night per witness statements. Jamie was unable to account for his whereabouts on Saturday night and his roommates could not vouch for him because he wasn't home. Jamie had owned a motorcycle and admitted to giving Pam a ride on it, possibly on Saturday night, and her pant leg was rolled up and grease was on it. Jamie had volunteered statements in his first interview, in which he theorized about what happened to Pam and how the homicide occurred, which were consistent with what actually took place. And then he stopped cooperating with the investigation. Jamie had a yellow car and replaced the carpeting. Finally, they believed that Pam had eaten Chinese food within an hour of death, and Jamie was reputed to love Chinese food and eat it frequently. They also knew that Jamie had been a heavy drinker around the time of the homicide and had a domestic incident filed by his ex-wife when she locked him out of the house and he kicked the door down. Investigator Parker's notes read, quote, "During the entire interview, Jamie rarely looked anyone in the eye, scraped the floor or ground with his foot, seemed to be attempting to conceive a plausible story, and was being overly helpful. At one point, Agent Gregory stated it was obvious Jamie was deceptive and was the worst liar he'd ever seen," end quote. The investigators noted with interest that the only time in over 3 hours of conversation that Jamie flatly denied killing Pam was when he went to tell his wife they were going to the hospital to give samples, and he said, "I didn't kill her, and that's all I can say." After they returned to Florida from South Carolina, Investigator Parker phoned Jamie's ex-wife, Marianne. She said he had called her at 5 o'clock p.m. that day as soon as they left and asked when they had started dating. He seemed to want assurance that they were already together in August 1984. Let me clarify what happened here. Jamie knew he didn't kill Pam, and he was anxious to get the investigators off his back where they had firmly placed themselves. If he had already been an item with Marianne when Pam was killed, it was much less likely that he would have been out carousing at the Mariners Club and meeting Pam, which, by the way, he had already admitted to. But Marianne said no, they didn't start dating until September 1984. And when she told the investigators about Jamie calling her, they took it to mean that Jamie had been asking her to lie and alibi him. So the investigators were all in on Jamie B. Apparently, the old case file contains notes and reports reflecting that the investigators were 100% convinced it was Jamie, and all they had to do was produce the evidence. But no arrest was forthcoming, and they had to back off Jamie because the samples he gave did not match the samples in evidence. What samples, you're asking? Well, let's get into it. It was the mid-1990s, and the physical evidence was ripe for updated testing. Sheriff's investigator Bob Janes took up the case in the mid-1990s. He oversaw several series of updated testing on the physical evidence in the case, and they hit pay dirt. An FDLE lab report by analyst Vivian Armstrong, dated July 25, 1996, identified the presence of semen on Pam's underwear. The semen stain was located on the side or hip portion of the underpants. No semen was located in the crotch area. No semen was identified on the pants located adjacent to her body either. But the small stain on the hip of the underwear was sufficient to yield a partial DNA profile. This must not have had sufficient loci for entry into CODIS because more testing was done in 2000. A report issued by the FDLE on May 1, 2000 states they re-examined the underwear and developed a DNA profile suitable for searching in the CODIS system. Of course, no match was found, because if one had been, we wouldn't be here. In 2005, further testing made some headway. A U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Lab report issued June 6, 2005, stated that a full suspect DNA profile had been obtained from the semen stain on the underpants and entered into CODIS with no match. But there was more. The NCIL lab also conducted analysis of the fingernail clippings taken at Pam's autopsy and identified two different partial DNA profiles. The first profile could not exclude Pam as being the contributor, but the second profile could not exclude the same person who was the origin of the unknown profile developed from the semen on the hip of the underwear as being the contributor of the DNA under Pam's nails. This was big. It indicated that the same man who had dripped semen on Pam's panties had likely been in contact with her fingernails, which usually means she scratched him hard. In 2010 and 2011, armed with these DNA results, investigators started a DNA collection campaign. Males mentioned in the case file were approached and requested to give DNA samples. These were men like Perry H., whose name had been on the pill bottle found in the bra. He was eliminated, as were all the others tested. NCIS officers and the sheriff's investigators undertook re-interviewing a lot of the original witnesses. One of these was Kim Z., who had been classmates with Pam and chatted with her that Saturday morning. In their 2010 meeting at a coffee shop, she told the NCIS investigators that Pam had told her she had a date that Saturday night with someone who was going to dental school to be a dental technician. He had a car, and they were going out. Men affiliated with the dental facilities on the base were of interest to the investigators for a couple reasons. One, it was the largest group in terms of specialty assignment on the base. naval seamen had to have access to dental services so they would not encounter tooth emergencies when deployed on ships for months at a time in the middle of the ocean. There were about 180 dental techs in three different posts on the one base. Two, the dental techs tended to socialize in packs and were known to be skeevy in terms of hitting on the female recruits. Apparently, it was a known thing that the dental guys would show up in groups on graduation day so they could pick up the fresh young recruits who had been cooped up for months and were now at liberty to go party and go on dates. And Jamie B., the original suspect, was a dental tech on the base. The investigators had been focusing on this subset of naval personnel at NTC Orlando for years, but Kim Z was the only person who ever connected Pam with a dental technician. It would turn out that she may have been right. On October 30th, 2012, an article ran in the Orlando Sentinel announcing a reward in the Pam Kahanas case. The article says, quote, "The new Seminole County Cold Case Working Group reopened the investigation into Kahanas' killing Monday and announced a $5,000 crime line reward. The local, state, and federal law enforcement officers met in Sanford to review its first case," end quote. That very same day, the crime line received a tip about Pam's murder. The tipster named a white male named Albert G. as the suspect and said that he was in the Orlando area at the time of the murder. He was in the Navy, and he had a very violent disposition. He currently lived in Jacksonville, Florida. Albert G. would prove to be a very intriguing suspect. Navy records showed that Albert G. was assigned to the USS O'Bannon, which was stationed in Charleston, South Carolina, from July 18, 1984 to August 27, 1984. Pam was killed on August 4th or 5th, 1984. Okay, I know what you're thinking. He can't be in Charleston, South Carolina and Sanford, Florida at the same time. Well, not so fast. On November 8, 2012, the investigators made contact with a woman named Cynthia H. She had been married to Albert G. from 1981 to 1986. She described him as an alcoholic who was very violently abusive to her during their marriage. At one point, he put her in the hospital. He broke her ribs and caused internal bleeding and kidney damage after she complained when one of his drunk friends peed on her bedroom floor. In another incident, he had threatened to kill her while pointing a gun at her before manually choking her. She fled to Florida from their Chicago home with their son. She filed for divorce, but eventually dropped the petition as she and Albert decided to try to work things out for the sake of their small child. That eventually ended because Albert persisted in beating her and choking her. And then this. Cynthia stated that at the time of Pam's murder, she and Albert were separated and she and their son David were living with her parents in Sanford, Florida, where she was from. Albert was assigned to the USS O'Bannon in Charleston at the time, but he would come down to his parents' house on most weekends so he could hang out with his friends. His parents resided at 721 Riverview Avenue in Sanford. The report states, quote, "It should be noted that Pamela's body was located at the east corner of West First Street and Riverview Avenue in Sanford in a vacant lot which is approximately three lots south of Albert G. Jr.'s parents," end quote. Did you get that? Albert's folks lived three houses from where Pam was found. Further, Cynthia believed that Albert was down visiting his parents that very weekend. They had talked about the murder, which happened right there in Sanford when it hit the news. The 2012 investigators were able to confirm from Navy records that Albert G. was on leave on the weekend that Pam was killed. Cynthia told them that he and his friends typically would drive around together looking for cheap places to drink and would often end up at the NTC Orlando base bar, the last place Pam Kahanas was believed to have been seen. Further, she said that Albert and his drunk buddies sometimes liked to, quote, share girls. And finally, Albert G. owned a motorcycle. Cynthia confided in the investigators that as soon as she heard about the murder, she immediately felt that Albert could have been responsible. Cynthia's father, whose name was literally Manly, backed all this up about Albert being a violent alcoholic. He said as soon as he heard about Pam's murder in Sanford, he thought of Albert, since it was so close to his parents' home. In fact, Manly admitted that he was the one who had called in Albert's name on the tip line. Albert and Cynthia's son David had legally changed his name when he turned 18 and had no contact whatsoever with his father. The investigators contacted David, who was now an adult, and obtained a voluntary buccal swab for Y-DNA comparison purposes. USA CIL forensic biologist Evelyn Ridgely issued a report dated December 11, 2012, that said David was excluded as a source of the male DNA obtained from Pamela's underwear. His Y-DNA did not match that of the Y-DNA left behind by the killer. Damn it. But wait, Albert's ex-wife, David's mother Cynthia, told Detective Spears that she wasn't certain that Albert was David's father. Okay, game on. And the investigators learned something else intriguing about Albert. Cynthia had given them a list of names of the Sanford men her ex hung out with. These were the guys who supposedly shared girls and drank and partied at the base bar at NTC Orlando. And one of them, whom I'm calling John P., had an intimate connection with the vacant home where Pam was found. His family owned it, and he used to live there. These guys just became even more interesting. Now, in 2012, investigator Bob Janes was still working the case for the Seminole County Sheriff's Office, and he was joined by seasoned detective Jennifer Spears. They continued the Albert G. and Cronies investigation together, along with the NCIS. It's hard to overstate how hard they worked this angle. Albert looked like a great suspect, and if David wasn't his son, then the non-matching Y DNA didn't matter. But it was also possible that a group of guys had been involved in what happened to Pam, and the nexus of both Albert and his buddy John P. to the house in Sanford where Pam was dumped sure made them look like viable suspects. The investigators wondered whether the vacant house could actually have been the place where Pam was killed after being abducted by this crew. They dug in. On January 30th, 2014, NCIS Special Agent Hansen, Investigator Bob Janes, and Detective Spears met with Albert. He acknowledged his ties to Sanford and his buddy John P.'s house, and that he was probably in town on the weekend of the murder, but he denied having anything to do with it. Albert refused to provide a DNA sample, and the investigators instead had to gather items he had touched during the interview: the business card he handled, the water bottle he drank during the interview, and the chair he was sitting on. Green looked all the more suspicious because several of his other friends who were named as part of his 1984 posse, including the Sanford homeowner's son himself, John P., all willingly gave DNA samples. All except one. This was a guy named Robert Baker, who raised the hackles of Detective Spears because he acted super hinky when they tried to talk to him. He refused to allow the detectives in his house or give a DNA sample. And he told the detectives he would never have been involved in Pam's death because he was saved by the Lord in August of 1984. The same month Pam was killed. Coincidence? The detectives were skeptical. They engineered it so that his workplace literally turned up the heat, so he sweated profusely and drank an entire bottle of water. They grabbed the water bottle he drank from and tested his DNA. Well, it wasn't him either. Meanwhile, Albert eventually came around and agreed to take a polygraph exam and provide a buccal swab after discussing the situation with his attorney. Much to the surprise of the investigators, the direct comparison ruled Albert out. The investigators were completely deflated. Detective Spears told me that after Jamie B., all her money was on Albert G. and his crew. To find out that all their work was for naught was demoralizing. They had collected nearly 150 DNA samples in all and had nothing to show for it. Bob Janes had desperately wanted to solve the case while Pam's mother Alice was still living, but she passed in 2016. He worked the case for 20 years, but couldn't even figure out for certain where the actual crime scene was. He told the Orlando Sentinel in 2015, the year he retired, quote, "She could have been killed in Winter Park or the Orlando area or on the Navy base, I don't know, or just transported over there and dumped," end quote. All those years later, the investigators still knew shockingly little about what had happened to Pam. Another angle that Detective Spears investigated was the remote possibility that Pam's ex-boyfriend, the one from Minnesota, had come down to Florida and killed her. The two had a long and fraught history and had broken up and gotten back together a number of times. Detective Spears wanted to test him, but he'd overdosed and drowned in a lake in Minnesota. Fortuitously, the medical examiner's office had a blood card on file. Tests on this sample ruled him out as well. They had officially exhausted all leads. This is the end of part one of three. Part two of three is available right now.